Prayer of Examen was designed really to help one discern God's presence and action in one's life. And so it's such a simple practice, but it's really incredible, because if we stick with it, we'll have more clarity. We'll have the eyes to see where God is at work and how God is at work in our life.
Hello, everyone. Glad to have you joining us here for another episode on the Voices Podcast. Gary here, hanging with you on a dark, stormy Pacific Northwest afternoon. I hope it's better wherever you might be tuning in from. But today I'm excited about what we're going to share with you, because we actually have a couple guests joining us on this episode. I asked my lovely wife, Lindsay, to interview Felina Hewart, which she is a part of the Gravity Center out in Omaha, Nebraska. And they're going to be talking about kind of an introductory view or lesson about contemplative spirituality or contemplative prayer. And I thought, of all people to do this interview, we should have Lindsay do it, because she actually just came back from going on a retreat with the Gravity Center and experiencing what Felina does week in and week out over there. So we're going to be listening to a conversation with both of them. Super excited for you to hear from both Lindsay and Felina. I think you're going to learn a lot, and it's going to be, a lot of what we talk about on here is like theology, Bible. And I think what's good about this specific episode is it's more about at a practitioner level. So we've had a few practitioners, you know, you think about Nate Stone from Bar Church or the Coffee Church down in Southern California with Steve Giralli. And so we have some practitioners, but now this is one that's more about not necessarily a church gathering, but more about your own personal spirituality, how you can grow and connect with God in new ways that, I think has been really helpful for me personally, as I've been on a few contemplative, meditative retreats myself, and just excited to share that with you, because I think that there will be some of you out there that might be thinking, what's worked for me, the kind of typical prayer is about me talking a bunch, and I just say a bunch of things, and it's like a verbal prattle that I've got to say all this stuff to God, or it's about I need to read my Bible and get certain things out of my Bible. While that's good and it's helpful, I think some of us hit a season where that just doesn't work anymore. And so now this idea of contemplative spirituality will take you into different forms of prayer and ways to connect, which maybe more are not so much about talking, but it's about listening. It's about just being present. It's being still and silent and in solitude. So I'm excited for you to hear about that, and maybe you'll gain some new ways to think about connecting with God that might be helpful for you in your journey. So with that very long intro we have today, let's roll it with Lindsay and Felina.
Okay, hi there, everyone. We are here today with Felina Hewart of the Gravity Center. And Felina, thanks so much for being here with us, first of all.
Sure, thanks for the invitation.
Would you go ahead and start for us? This is our introduction to the contemplative practices, and I can imagine this is probably uncharted territory for a lot of us listening. Would you talk to us about what first drew you into the contemplative practices, and kind of what are they? Where do they come from? I know that's
sure.
A lot right off the bat.
Yeah, sure. So, I grew up in a typical kind of evangelical home, and grew up going to church three times a week, at least. My father was a pastor. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really well acquainted with the way in which a lot of us have experienced church and Christianity and, how to relate to our faith. But, right out of college, I got involved in an international social justice organization, and quickly found myself co-leading that with my husband. And we were working with children with HIV and AIDS, former child soldiers and war brides, and women and girls that were coming out of the commercial sex trade. And we ended up working with about 300 staff in 13 cities around the world. And it was just really intense work, as you can imagine. So we were kind of just plunged into human suffering and really human brutality in the face of war and poverty and such. And so it wasn't long before the practices that had sustained me in my faith journey as a Christian began to fall short. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, there's a very clear turning point for me at the peak of the war over blood diamonds in Freetown, Sierra Leone. And I came back from that visit. We were trying to determine how to respond to these young girls that had been subjected to domestic and sexual slavery within war, and then the soldiers who had actually committed such crimes and atrocities against these girls. We met them as well, and I was faced with such incredible paradox. Like, these girls were victims, but these boys were also victims, and here these boys now were victimizing the young girls. And it, you know, I'd seen a lot of human suffering, and I'd seen a lot of the ways in which we can cause harm to one another, but I'd never been faced with such a stark contrast, I guess, in terms of what it means to be a victim and what it means to be an oppressor, and how those roles can easily merge, where a victim becomes an oppressor. Mm-hmm. And so I was faced with this paradox, and I was really struggling to make sense of it in my mind. And I came back from all of that and was, you know, my faith had always been really important to me, and I was always quite committed to prayer, actually. But I found that I couldn't pray. Mm-hmm. I found that scripture didn't really meet the questions and the doubts and the pain that I was really dealing with. And it seemed as if, you know, going to church and what I was hearing in church services and stuff, it's like it wasn't meeting the real dynamic, complicated issues that I was encountering in the world. Like, what does this scripture have to do with these young girls and these young boys who have been both incredibly brutalized, and the boys end up brutalizing others? Like, how does any of this in our church and in our Christian experience, how does it have anything to do with what they're dealing with? Mm-hmm. And so this was a classic kind of example of coming into a crisis of faith, where the practices that used to sustain me in my relationship with God and my faith journey were falling short. And it really brought me to my knees. I mean, I felt I couldn't go on. I felt really limited in my capacity to keep growing spiritually and as a Christian in the face of these challenges and paradoxes. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't long after that I met a Cistercian monk named Thomas Keating, who's still living today. He's quite old. He's in his 90s. And he visited our hometown here in Omaha, Nebraska, and Chris's, my husband, his spiritual director at the time, just called one morning and said, "What are you doing this evening? I'm inspired to invite you to dinner with this monk," his teacher at the time. And we knew nothing of Thomas Keating or the contemplative tradition or any of that. But it was really just an incredible, the timing was incredible, given that I was at such a breaking point in my faith. And so it was Thomas that introduced me to the Christian contemplative tradition and a practice called centering prayer. Okay. And so this is how it all sort of began for me.
Wow. That is an incredible story, incredible beginning. And while I haven't done any kind of traveling or much social justice work, I do feel like there are pieces that I can relate to in your story that brought me maybe to a similar place of even just encountering pain and then noticing that the practices that had been working are no longer working for me. Unfortunately, I had not had the opportunity for an introduction to Thomas Keating. That's fantastic timing. Such a gift.
Mm.
And yes. So what I got connected with the Gravity Center, which is the nonprofit that you and Chris started together. Is that correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that's what introduced me to contemplative practices. Could you talk a bit more about, you mentioned centering prayer. Mm-hmm. What is that, and how did you begin?
Yeah, great. So, if I could just comment on what you were saying around pain, I think mm-hmm. that's a really critical insight that often, you know, okay, so we can be religious, we can be Christian, we can, you know, be faithful to the church services and perhaps like Bible study and devotion and those kinds of things, certainly a type of prayer that we can be devoted to. But I think there's an important distinction between being committed to a religion or committed as a Christian and embarking on the spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. And that, that what you highlighted around pain, I think is really critical, because it seems to me that we really enter the spiritual journey, because of great pain and suffering or great joy and love. And so there's a distinction to be made, in terms of how we go about living our faith. And it seems to me that that contemplative prayer, contemplative practices really come into one's life when they're eager to go deeper in their faith journey or in their spiritual journey. And contemplative prayer supports that ongoing faith journey in a way that really no other practices do. So, regarding like the practices around contemplative spirituality, I mentioned centering prayer. There's also Lectio Divina, the prayer of examine, labyrinth prayer, mm-hmm. breath prayer, the welcoming prayer. I mean, there's quite a few. We focus on those that I've mentioned. Mm-hmm. And those that I've mentioned, with the exception of welcoming prayer, are all rooted in our Christian faith tradition. The problem is that, many of these practices, like the contemplative dimension of our Christian faith, has been largely lost to us in the West, mm-hmm. in the Christian West. And there's reasons for that. If you want me to go into that, I can.
I think maybe just touching on that for a couple of minutes could be helpful for how we've been disconnected and what our new focus has been in the mm-hmm. West.
Mm-hmm. So I can point to the Great Schism in 1054, when there was a disagreement between two different popes that had been established in the Christian faith. And so the church at that point really split into the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. So before that, it was one church, and the contemplative tradition of the faith was integrated for the most part. It seems that the Eastern Church really was able to hold on to the contemplative tradition in a way that the Western Church did not. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, we began to see some distancing in the Christian West from the contemplative dimension. Later then, at the time of the Protestant Reformation, when the Protestants broke away from the Roman Catholic Church, they become even more distanced from the contemplative tradition. So what we find is that in the Christian West, the contemplative dimension of our faith started to become really more isolated in the monastic communities, mm-hmm. Where people were, you know, taking vows to submit themselves to a life of prayer. And so the average lay person grew more distant from that. To add a challenge to the whole deal around the contemplative dimension of our faith, around the time of the Enlightenment, there was a real departure from the intuitive right brain in favor for mm-hmm. the intellectual discursive left brain. And so we began to see an overemphasis on relating to our faith through the rational mind. And in that regard, we neglected the more intuitive, contemplative dimension of our being and how that also has an intelligence and relates to faith. And so in our times now, there has been such a renewal to bring together both, in a sense, the left and right brain, the rational and the contemplative dimension of our faith.
Mm-hmm. And so you've talked about how the contemplative practices are a response to wanting to go deeper on this spiritual journey. And the differentiation between being committed to religion and committed to journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so what have you found that these practices offer that are different from what was before?
Great question. So I'll speak to this really from more of my personal, experience, and because everyone's experience will be slightly different, but mm-hmm. to try to illustrate, what is it that makes these practices so profound in one's life, and why, what is it that I've experienced from these practices that I didn't experience before? And mm-hmm. I would start with self-awareness. So contemplative practices have a way of really waking up this inner observer, you could call it the Holy Spirit, who is observing my life and my character and my personality and my relationships and who I am. And so contemplative prayer really has a way of igniting this self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And I always say that self-awareness is the beginning of liberation. And so we have to live so much of life before we are really ready for this kind of deep self-awareness. Mm. We have to sort of form a self, if you will, before we can then observe it. And that takes time to form a personality, and kind of make our way in the world as a particular person. But then when we are ready for contemplative practice, what that does is it really, shines a light on who we think we are. And we've spent a lot of life creating that person, that persona. But what we realize is that who we thought we were isn't necessarily who we truly are.
Hmm.
And so contemplative practice has a way of showing me, what parts of myself are really just a mask, which persona, the root of that word really means mask. So what part of me is actually a mask to my true essence? Like, how am I covering over or hiding parts of myself that are really true and important to bring forward in the world?
Mm-hmm.
And contemplative teachers, spiritual teachers, and beginning with the Apostle Paul, just make this distinction. They show us that within us are really two dimensions. There's an old creation, the Apostle Paul says, and a new creation. And Paul, I love how he writes about, why is it that I do what I don't want to do, and what I don't want to do, that's the very thing I do.
Mm-hmm.
He illuminates in those texts the dynamic between this old and new creation and how they are at war with one another, how they are really, there's just an incredible conflict between these two dimensions of ourself. And so spiritual teachers in our tradition, have taken that teaching, and, one teacher in particular, Thomas Merton, who lived in the 50s and 60s, really at the height of his spiritual work during the 50s and 60s, he, brought the terminology true self, false self.
Okay.
And so what contemplative prayer does is it, with that self-awareness, we begin to recognize the old and new creation, or the false self and the true self within us. And that then leads to incredible discernment, to be able to begin to start to notice, when am I living out of my false self, and when am I living out of my true self, and how can I really take responsibility for my life and who I am, and nurture and nourish that true self dimension of me so that I can offer the best of myself to my family, my relationships, my community, and the world around me.
That's very so helpful. I've had an unique experience or an interesting experience with what you were just talking about. And even as I was reading your book, in your book, it says the spiritual journey is an invitation to know God and be known by God, which necessitates that one finds and knows oneself. And, I just know with my background and in conversations I was having around this new idea that was new to me of knowing yourself first in order to know God, it was almost backwards from what I had grown up with of maybe you almost even ignore yourself and only seek to know God. And that is a true faithful lifestyle. And, that this idea of intentionally knowing yourself, it brings some clarity to the whole journey.
Yeah, I know. Some of the teaching that we get in the church can be so confusing because this notion of denying self is often miscommunicated. So certainly Jesus says, if you want to follow me, take up your cross, deny yourself, you know. But the problem is that you cannot deny yourself until you have a self to deny.
Yes.
And so most of us, you know, who've grown up in the church, I mean, we're still children when we're being taught, our brains aren't even fully developed and we're being taught to deny the self. Hmm. But it's like the self hasn't even fully formed yet. We're not ready for that kind of self-denial until we have a more actualized sense of self. And that doesn't happen generally until we're much older in the brain. What is it? The brain isn't fully developed until you're like 26 years old or something like that.
Yeah. Just making it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, let's give time and patience, you know, and wait. I think we force people into, so many spiritual dimensions of following Christ before we're actually ready and able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first part of our life really needs to be about nurturing and nourishing one's understanding of God. That, mm-hmm. And I think many of us, we subvert so much of that groundwork around our understanding and knowledge of God to be forced into a spiritual journey that we're not ready for, so that when we actually are older and somewhat more mature and have an actual self to lay down and deny, we've not got the groundwork for things like, am I really truly loved and accepted by God? Mm-hmm. What does God really think of me? Does God truly love me? So what I see in my spiritual direction work is a lot of Christians who are ready for the spiritual journey in one sense because they have a fully actualized self to lay down, but they don't have the foundational work that should have occurred in our, you know, younger years within the church, where one is formed in this inseparable connection with God, the God of love, who loves us unconditionally. And scripture says absolutely nothing can separate us from the love of God.
Mm.
So I think maybe some of our teaching in the church is a little out of order or a little bit confused in the way that we're teaching and forming people in what it means to be a Christian and a follower of Jesus, especially now that we have insight into psychological development, brain development, and that type of thing. All of it comes into play, I think, now in our time, to understand better what it means to be committed to Jesus and following a spiritual path.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like another book to me. As a mother with kids and growing up in church, yes.
Yeah.
Clarity around all of that is so important.
Mm.
Okay, let's see. I kind of interrupted you actually because you were talking about your own experience and what these contemplative practices brought to you. And
yeah, I wanted to get to that, and I think I got sidetracked a little bit as well.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So for my own life, what happened was, you know, I came to, in that crisis of faith in Freetown, Sierra Leone, what was happening was I was really coming to the end of myself. And I was realizing that all of my good work in the world, couldn't possibly make all the difference that I was hoping it could make. Mm-hmm. I was coming to the limits of myself, and that really, interestingly enough, shed light on some questions and doubts I had around God and the limits of God. And, you know, big theological questions around why does God let people suffer? Mm-hmm. You know, those types of things. So I was coming into the limits of all of that, and I was moving really from a place of certainty in my faith to a place of doubt and mm-hmm. questions, which in my upbringing, there wasn't really room for doubts and questions.
Right.
I had to, you know, jump in with certainty, but then my life experience, the pain I was encountering was challenging that certainty that I once was so sure about.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I gave myself to contemplative prayer, over time, what happened was I found a way, first of all, to be with God, with my doubts and questions. That gave rise to a lot of inner pain. And then in time, God began to show me the ways in which I was living out of my false self in the world. And so, particularly for me, I'm a two, type two on the Enneagram, for those who are familiar with the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. And the type two is really invested in being what other people need her to be or what she thinks other people need from her. So a lot of my service in the world was motivated from this broken place, if you will, around, mm-hmm. Needing to be needed. And there's nothing wrong with meeting others' needs, but when my whole sense of self, my identity was wrapped up in being for other people what they needed me to be, there was a lack of personal freedom there. Mm-hmm. I was really trapped in these inner unconscious motivations around needing to be approved of, needing to be accepted. So by meeting other people's needs, I sort of got a back-ended way of like feeling loved, mm-hmm. Feeling accepted. And so what God began to do in my life was to show me this brokenness, if you will, this St. Ignatius of Loyola calls it disordered attachments. Mm-hmm. So I was attached to meeting the needs of other people, which revealed that this was disordered, and God was wanting to bring order out of that so that I could be more free in the world to truly love without sort of a passive aggressive, manipulative, unconscious way of getting love.
Mm.
And so then through contemplative practice, really God began to do some of that foundational work that I missed out on in my earlier formation around knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am loved and accepted by God, mm. and that there's nothing that can separate me from that. And being rooted in that knowing that is beyond an intellectual, rational mind knowing,
mm-hmm.
from like doctrinal ideas or from reading scripture, it was now becoming like a lived reality for me, like in my bones, in my DNA, like knowing that I am connected to God. I am loved by God. There's nothing that can separate me from that. And when I'm rooted in that love, then that creates incredible freedom to freely love others and be of service to others without being, in bondage to that service or having to do it because there's this empty part of me that is unconsciously trying to get filled and mm-hmm. in this kind of back way. So am I being clear? Do you have any questions around this before I go further?
No, I think that is making sense. And even just, cause I think the, most of us are unfamiliar with even just what centering prayer is, or breath, or examine, and what that meant for you. Like, mm-hmm. I can see in your story the transformations that mm-hmm. that took place, are taking place, mm-hmm. and what practicing these things, just what that is, I guess, what that even looks like.
Mm. So centering prayer, that really was the particular contemplative practice that I was drawn to. And what that is, for the listeners who have no idea, mm-hmm. It is a silent prayer practice where we commit for a minimum of 20 minutes to sit in silence with nothing but a sacred symbol, which can be a word, an image. It could be simply the breath. And what we do during the silence is we gently introduce that sacred symbol in our mind, and in our heart, as our symbol to consent to the presence and action of God within us. Mm. And so it's virtually just a practice of consent for 20 minutes or however long you sit, and mm-hmm. you can work up to the 20 minutes. You don't yes. have to start at that right away. But, this practice of consent, of saying yes to God, even in the midst of my doubts, my questions, my pain, what that does over time is it builds incredible trust between myself and God, and it uncovers a lot of courage to then follow God wherever God would lead. And so through centering prayer, I was over time just slowly, you know, more freed from the false self, growing in courage to then offer my truest, best self to the world, even if that meant at times saying no, or at times, just determining like, yes, I see your need, but I am not the one to meet that need. Mm-hmm. Like making those distinctions. I think about Jesus a lot in that regard, how the Gospels, you know, show us how Jesus was walking, you know, along roads or in various crowds. And there were lots of people with need, mm-hmm. but the scriptures tell us that he only stopped for certain people. Mm-hmm. He only healed certain people, you know, and he had that clarity, that discernment of what was his responsibility, what God was calling him to, who God was calling him to be with. And we need that kind of clarity too, that kind of discernment to know exactly like today, this is mine to do. This isn't mine to do. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the person I'm meant to meet with. This person I am not meant to meet with. Like, mm. things like that are, I think, really critical for our times when we get overwhelmed with all of the needs around us and all of the responsibilities. How can we be freer to do the portion of work that God has given us to do?
Hmm. And okay, so that is centering prayer. And would you mind going into the prayer of examine? Because that's my personal favorite at this point.
Yeah. So the prayer of examen was really crafted by St. Ignatius of Loyola, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. in the 16th century. He's one of the doctors of the church, one of the three renowned Spanish mystics after Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. And the prayer of examen was designed really to help one discern God's presence and action in one's life. And so it's such a simple practice, but it's really incredible because if we stick with it, we'll have more clarity. We'll have the eyes to see where God is at work and how God is at work in our life. Mm-hmm. And so by, like the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus is the order that St. Ignatius founded, and then the men who are part of that order are called Jesuits, and they practice this at midday and then at the end of the day. Mm. And it's an examen of consciousness. So it's not an examen of conscience where we're scanning to see like what did I do bad? What did I do good? What did I do wrong? What did I do right? It's an examine of consciousness. So becoming more aware, so deepening one's awareness of God's presence and action in their life. And we do that through scanning over the previous day or the previous hours. And we notice, you know, we begin with gratitude, first of all. And then we notice what has been consoling. Where are the consolations in my day? What really felt good? What made me happy? What made me energized, enthusiastic, like all of those kinds of good energy kinds of feelings and experiences. Mm-hmm. And we look at that and we make note of that. And Ignatius was very good at reminding us that God is in all things. God can be found in all of life. And so in those good experiences, we can recognize God's presence.
Mm-hmm.
But then we go on to look for a desolation. When did I feel bad? When did I feel sad? When did I experience these low, negative kinds of emotions or energies? Or when did I have bad experiences in the day? And we like in the consolations, we try and focus on one. In the desolations, we also focus on one. And just like Ignatius reminding us that God is found in these good experiences, God is also found in the difficult, trying, awful experiences of life. But that's usually when we feel most distant from God and when God seems most absent from us is yes. when things aren't going well. So this is a great opportunity to expand our awareness, our consciousness, and be able to begin to find God in even those difficult experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we've examined the consolations and desolations, then we can commit ourselves anew to the grace that has been given us for a new day, and new consolations and desolations. And what this does over time is it really deepens our trust that no matter what happens in life, God is with us and God is at work in us and around us.
Mm.
And that kind of awareness is just so incredibly grounding, because I think often we want life circumstances to make us feel better,
mm-hmm.
to make us feel happy, to make us feel satisfied. But we know through life that circumstances are going to come and go, and we have no guarantee what life is going to bring us. But we do have this rooted, grounded guarantee of being in God and God being in us. And that's what we can put our trust in.
Hmm.
We can't put our trust in the circumstances of life. They're going to change all the time, and good things are going to happen and bad things are going to happen. And it's going to be difficult at times, but we can put our trust in God, who is always with us, always leading us, and really with our best interest at heart, like knowing, trusting that God is at work in me. And even in these bad things that happen, I can find hope because God is at work. And we begin to see over time how God is actually at work in us to grow us, to change us, to free us, to transform us into the people that God has created us to be in service of one another.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And along with those two practices of the several that you've mentioned, in your book, you talk a lot about silence, stillness, and solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And could you just briefly go over why do those things matter to us?
Yeah, great. So contemplative practice really is rooted in the elements of solitude, silence, and stillness. And while it can be helpful to create outer solitude, silence, and stillness, what we're concerned with here is really the interior solitude, silence, and stillness. And in solitude, when we practice solitude, we are actually developing capacity to be more present. So by withdrawing and going inward, we are developing capacity then to, when we are with other people and when we are engaged in our active life, we can actually show up and be more present to the people in our life, the tasks at hand. And if you think about it, often this is what is so difficult in our life, because even though, you know, here we are visiting on this podcast and people are listening in, notice how difficult it is to be right here, right now, how much we're living with our mind in the past or in the future. And so practicing solitude helps us to be more present so that we can actually, you know, suck the marrow out of life, like be present, be here, like enjoy the abundance that is right here, right now. And then silence, as we practice silence, then we actually develop capacity to listen. So by getting quiet and going inside and contending with the silence that is actually God's first language, we're often afraid of the silence. But as we grow more comfortable with the silence, we're practicing silence, then we develop this capacity to really hear, to hear ourselves, what's going on within us, to hear God more clearly, and then to hear one another when we're engaged in our active life. So being more present and able to hear more acutely gives us incredible power to be loving witnesses in the world. And then stillness. Through stillness, we actually develop capacity to show restraint and discernment. So by practicing stillness, you know, often we are, when we're engaged in the world, we're triggered all the time. And in our most animal nature, our fight flight response is triggered in our nervous system. And things happen and we either fight it or we flee it. And sometimes that's fighting another person, and sometimes it's fleeing another person. So you can imagine in your own relationships how often you have been triggered, and the people listening, you know, how often we're triggered in that way.
Yes.
And so by practicing stillness, we develop this self-control, this ability to be restrained from that impulse to fight or flee. And then through discernment, we discover how to respond in the most loving way, you know. And really what we're doing in all of these contemplative practices, and by cultivating solitude, silence, and stillness, is we are cultivating the presence of Jesus who is in us. So we know that we are the temple of the Holy Spirit. We know that Christ has made his home within us. And so we are creating space for the Christ life to be lived in and through us more fully.
Yes. And oh my goodness, the silence, stillness, and solitude, such a challenge and so worth it. I had a chance to be with Chris and Felina at one of their retreats this last weekend. And it was the grounding retreat, which is an introduction, and I highly recommend it. We'll have the link to those. They're available once a year, each of your retreats. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. We'll have information for that in the show notes. But Felina, I am wondering, for someone who doesn't have the opportunity to go on a retreat to just be introduced to these practices and actually try them out, do you have any kind of recommendations for how someone might begin on their own?
Yeah, so our website is set up with a pull-down menu for practices, and each of the practices I've mentioned are listed there. That's a great place to start to get informed about the practices, and there are instructions there about taking, you know, adopting one of these practices and trying them out. So I think that's a great first place to
Definitely.
Start.
Yes. And then I mentioned your book several times in the interview, and it's called Pilgrimage of a Soul, and you just re-released that. And can you tell us a little bit about what's now included in that?
Yeah. So Pilgrimage of a Soul is basically a spiritual memoir or a theological narrative around my awakening and initial aspects of the spiritual journey that I've encountered. I focus on 7 movements of the soul: awakening, longing, darkness, death, transformation, intimacy, and union. And in this new revised version, we have reflection questions at the end of each chapter, along with a spiritual practice. So it really is designed to help individuals integrate what they're learning through my book, to identify their own story and kind of where they're at in the spiritual journey and in those movements of soul, and reflect more deeply on that and be guided with a spiritual practice that will enhance their spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. Also, the questions are designed in such a way that they can be really helpful for group settings.
Mm-hmm. That is exactly what I found in reading it myself, and being able to recognize myself in your own story. And I actually did just get the re-release version, because I'm so excited about the questions and the practices, mm-hmm. and just being more exposed, since I am at the beginning of trying these contemplative practices. I'm so excited for what they'll bring about.
Great.
Okay. Well, Felina, thank you so much for your time. And I'm so looking forward to seeing your work in the world, and so thankful for your influence.
Thank you, Lindsay. It's really been great to be with you today. Thanks for making time.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us, so make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.